I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We've been led to believe that newspapers are dying and that sooner rather than later we won't read newsprint any longer, that they'll become obsolete. Granted that a lot of folks are reading their news off of screens and tablets, does that mean the newspaper takes on a new life and bandwidth on the internet? Mark Etch has written a new book, greatly exaggerated, The Myth of the Death of Newspapers. It's a compelling case that he makes that newspapers are in fact adapting and thriving. He even suggests they're not going anywhere. There's a lot of insight and research in this book. The history of the newspaper is discussed, going back to the days of Pulitzer and Hearst, as well as more recent history with papers in North America converging with other media outlets, some longtime names shutting down, and the economic realities of publications at the mercy of Wall Street. Mark Etch has been a reporter and editor with the Vancouver Province and Calgary Herald. He's been a professor of journalism in Canada, the United States, Fiji, and Singapore. His previous books include Pacific Press, Red Line, Blue Line, Bottom Line, and Aspernation, which he was on with back in 2008. He lives in Richmond on a sailboat, but joins me in studio today. The website for more is at markedge.com. The book is published by New Star Books. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Mark Etch. Dr. Etch, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So if we're to buy the premise that, newspapers aren't dying, who's saying that they are dying?
It's mostly technology enthusiasts, people who believe that the internet is the way of the future and the only way of the future, that the internet will leave all previous media in its dust. I don't believe that's true. I believe the internet certainly is a wonderful advancement in technology. It is a new medium, but the history of media has shown that a new medium doesn't supplant old media, that the old media adapt. This has been, the way ever since radio came in the 1920s. The 20th century was a century of new media. First it was film, then it was radio. Well, radio was supposed to put newspapers out of business. Who would ever want to read a newspaper again? It was argued when you can listen to somebody read you the news on the radio. Well, it didn't quite work out that way. Radio has its peculiarities, and it does some things very well. It has much more immediacy than newspapers. You can even broadcast, the voices of newsmakers themselves, but it's not really suitable for in-depth analysis and things like that. The way it's worked out is it's best for short bulletins of news, and then the other thing it's good at is talk. So newspapers survived and they adapted and they became even more profitable than before. Then television, of course, came along and everybody said, well, that's the end of newspapers. Television, not only did it have the immediacy of radio, but it also contained pictures, so people, the theory was, would get their news from television rather than newspapers. And television did indeed kill off a type of newspaper, which was the afternoon newspaper. When I was growing up, my dad used to come home from work and put his feet up and read the afternoon newspaper, as the Vancouver Sun then was. People don't do that anymore. They come home from work, put their feet up, and watch TV. So most afternoon newspapers either went out of business or switched to a morning publication in a phenomenon that was called Death in the Afternoon, more than just a bullfighting novel by Hemingway. So, yes, the history of new media has been a history not of displacement, but of adaptation. So this is what I predict will continue.
So will the, because people like Arthur Sulzberger, is he the owner of the Times, I guess?
Yes, the Sulzberger family owns the Times.
Yeah, so, I mean, he said that the print edition of the paper could be gone in a few years. I mean, do you think that we won't be either getting the paper delivered to us, or we won't buy it at a newsstand, say? I mean, the actual physical newspaper, is that...
Yes, I read the comment by Sulzberger, and I think the New York Times is under a lot of scrutiny. It's a lightning rod as far as newspapers go, and there's been a lot of speculation, and a lot of this speculation has emanated from New York City, from universities there, which are proclaiming digital only as the way of the future. And the problem with newspapers is the people who run them really don't know what the future is going to hold. And so a lot of them, some of them have even gone online only. The Seattle Times went online only. The Madison Capital Times went online mostly. They still have a weekly supplement in the other newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. But I think they are now regretting that because there doesn't seem to be much of a future in online-only news. The economics of it are just about the opposite of what the economics for the newspaper business are. The business model for newspapers is monopoly. If you can get a monopoly, of course, you can charge as much as you want for ads and for subscriptions. The Internet, of course, nobody can monopolize the Internet. So the business model there is infinite supply. Anybody can start up a website and sell advertising, which tends to drive advertising rates down. So if you look at it from a purely financial point of view, the future of online media may be limited, whereas there's actually still quite a bit of money to be made in newspaper advertising, even though it's gone down by more than half in the U.S., I think close to 60%, and in Canada not quite so much because we didn't suffer from the recession as badly. But from a strictly financial point of view, I believe newspapers will continue to publish in print because there's more money in print advertising. It's been found to be fairly effective, and in fact, the types of people that a lot of advertisers want to reach are newspaper readers. They tend to be more educated, more affluent, more engaged in their communities. So for all these reasons, I predict that newspapers will continue to publish in print form for the foreseeable future.
So we have in this city, in Vancouver, we have the Sun, the Broadsheet, the Tabloid, the Province, the commuter paper, 24 Hours. The first two are owned by Post Media. The third is owned by Quebecor. There was a deal recently announced that Post Media will buy the Quebecor papers, including, so in this city, those three papers will be owned by one owner, conceivably. And then you have sort of the weekly papers like, the community papers, I should say, like the Courier, Vancouver Courier, which comes out twice a week, the West Ender, the Georgia Strait. When you have the three, I guess those are the three big papers in this town, not counting the Globe and Mail, of course, owned by one person. Is that where you're talking about when you're talking about, say, a monopoly?
Yes. Well, the original monopoly was Pacific Press, right, and they were allowed to go into business together, even though an investigation found it to be an illegal combination and restraint of trade. They made the argument that it was an economic necessity, that if they weren't allowed to go into business together, eventually, under what's called the natural monopoly theory of newspapers, there would only be one newspaper in Vancouver. Well, this ignores the fact that there were then three newspapers in Vancouver, and they bought the third newspaper, the Times-Herald, and folded it. But then the monopoly grew in the 1980s. Southam, which had bought the Vancouver Sun from Thompson Newspapers in 1980, so they owned both dailies, the Sun and the Province. In the 1980s, they bought up most of the community newspapers. They owned the Vancouver Courier, the North Shore News, the Now newspapers. They recently divested those. So actually, the concentration of ownership of news media in Vancouver has loosened considerably, especially since the bankruptcy of Canwest Global Communications, which their newspaper and television divisions were sold off separately out of bankruptcy. So they had BCTV, which is the provincial superstation in television. Mm-hmm. So they had not only both daily newspapers and one of the national dailies, the National Post, most of the community newspapers, and the largest television station. So they had an iron grip on media in Vancouver until just a couple of years ago, I guess 4 years ago now, since Canwest was sold off out of bankruptcy. So things in Vancouver have improved considerably. Unfortunately, with their latest deal, which is Post Media buying the Sun Media mm-hmm. newspapers across the country, most of which are second-place tabloids like the Province, it seems we're going to have similar situations to Pacific Press in Edmonton, Calgary, and Ottawa, where Post Media will own both daily newspapers. They'll also have two dailies under this deal in Winnipeg and Toronto, where there's at least some competition. So speaking of competition, the Competition Bureau does have to approve this deal, and we're just waiting to see if they will.
And do you think they will?
I suspect they will, because that's been their history. I don't know if they will hold hearings, though. Yeah. I would like them to hold hearings and take submissions, because I think it's important to have public input into these types of media mergers, because there's a lot at stake in terms of media. Once one company is able to monopolize the news media in a city, like they did in Vancouver for many years here, like I say, they can hike up the advertising rates as high as they want, and there's no competition.
So when Mr. Godfrey and the people at Post Media say that they want to buy these papers, what's the reason that they're giving? Is that they're going to keep all three, and that these three papers will be viable advertising sources of revenue?
Well, they believe that they can make a go of it financially, and I believe they're right. You see them reporting all sorts of astronomical losses financially, but most of these losses are strictly on paper. When you drill down into their earnings reports, they're actually making a fairly good profit margin in terms of operating earnings, but some of the accounting rules state that they have to regularly revalue the value of their business, and it's been going down. There's no doubt about it, because their revenues have been falling, and their earnings have been falling. The business is simply worth less than it once was. It's not worthless, it's just worth less. Mm. So that money has to come off the books somewhere, and they take it off of earnings. And so I always look at gross earnings, which is operating earnings, rather than net earnings, which has all these extraordinary deductions from them.
And so, I mean, how do you see newspapers making money 5-10 years down the road? Because, I mean, if we're to believe that advertising revenue is going down, I mean, will we see, say, an uptick in that in the near future?
What I found in studying the finances of newspapers is that they seem to be incredibly adaptable. You know, you have large newspapers and you have small newspapers. You can make small newspapers larger by hiring more people and adding more pages, and you can make large newspapers smaller by laying off people and having fewer pages, and that's what we've been seeing lately. The business model for newspapers seems to be quite robust, because they are able to lower their costs below the level of their plunging revenues, and like I say, they still have a quite enviable profit margin of in the teens as far as Post Media goes, but they are becoming smaller businesses. So this is, I believe, what will continue to happen. I expect the advertising revenues to plateau, bottom out at some point. Also, newspapers have been charging more for readers. Mm-hmm. They've been raising the cover price.
It's like $1.50 for the Sun now, or something like that.
It's quite a bit higher than it was, that's for sure. Also, now they're charging for online access. So the business model for newspapers is extremely complex. Not you're operating not just in one market, the market for information and selling information to readers. You're also operating in the market for advertising, so you have to kind of balance those two inputs. And in recent years in North America, it's been quite unbalanced, because by far the highest percentage of revenues has come from advertising. Publishers have kept their cover prices artificially low in order to get their circulation up as high as possible, because advertising rates are based on circulation. So the more readers they have, the more they can charge for advertising. But now that the advertising bubble has basically burst, they're now expecting readers to pay more. A recent study by the OECD showed that in the U.S., in 2010, I think it was, newspapers took in about 7/8 of their revenues from advertising, which was by far the highest in the world. I think Canada was next at about 3/4. So what you're seeing now is that with less revenue from advertising, they're charging more for readers, both to buy the newspaper and to read it online.
So I'm This next question comes from the place of from the point of view of a news consumer, of which I am. I'm 32. I subscribe to The Sun. That's about it. Everything else I get online. I don't have any online subscriptions. Like, I don't subscribe to the New York Times or the Globe and Mail online. But, you know, I read, and then I wait till the meter runs out, and then, you know, I'm stuck, right? But you know, I'm not internet savvy enough that, I mean, I'm internet savvy enough that I can find what I want to read. Like, if I want to read, say, Andrew Coyne or Margaret Wente, if I'm ever compelled to, I can find the column, even though it's probably behind a paywall. So I'm of a generation, and there are people younger than me, who aren't, I guess, used to paying for news. How does that change?
Well, this is the problem, because most newspaper readers, readers of the print product, are older and getting older all the time. It's been noticed for years that young people don't read newspapers, but as they grow older and become more engaged in politics and start paying taxes and wondering where their money's going and taking more of an interest in the news, that they eventually take up the newspaper reading habit. The best argument out there for the death of newspapers is that young people, when they grow up, they won't have to read the newspaper because they have found these alternative sources of news, like you say. But with the recent move by most newspapers to go behind a paywall and charge for online readers, I think this is their best hope, you know, for survival, that if people want to read the news that they carry, and they have by far still, even with the reduced staffs, they still have the, you know, the largest news gathering operations in most communities, that they will eventually have to pay for it. Like I say, the economics of online media mitigate against large news gathering staffs, so they will eventually, theoretically, have to go to newspapers for their news, and hopefully this is what will keep newspapers in business.
And the Apple model, I guess, is something that works, isn't it? I mean, even though we can probably, if we're savvy enough, download a movie or music illegally. There are a lot of, Apple's not going out of business with the iTunes store and selling music and movies, I mean, of good quality. I mean, young people are buying stuff off of there, right? And I think the newspaper business can charge, say, what they ought to in terms of the product that they're putting out, in terms of quality columnists or long-form journalism even, that you could only find on a website.
Yes, and the micropayments model, the iTunes model, was proposed for newspapers, but they didn't have the digital infrastructure to set that up, and so the metered paywall model is the current model. Whether micropayments will come into vogue, I don't know. Perhaps that might become an alternative. If you just wanted to read one or two articles, you could pay per article. But there are ways around the paywall. In fact, when I was interviewing the publisher of the San Francisco Chronicle, who told me, well, you know, all you have to do is delete your cookies, your browser history, and so those little cookies can't tell that you've already read your 10 articles, so you can do that. You can read it in an incognito window. You can read it, apparently, by search. If you go on Google and take the headline that you've read online, but unable to read the article, Google the headline, and apparently you can get the article via search or Facebook. It's an interesting phenomenon that in Europe, you know, a lot of publishers there have been fighting Google, claiming that they've been stealing their news, and yet when they've enacted regulations, prohibiting Google from doing this, some of the publishers have waived that and said, no, we want Google to find our headlines because that's what drives traffic to our pages.
And the interesting thing that I read in your book was that, because we've all heard that the newspaper business didn't foresee the internet, you write that they did, or that they could see this coming. Now, what happened there then? Did they not act upon what the warnings say? Or?
Well, they saw the coming of the information society, let's put it that way. Nobody, I don't think, could have known the way it would have turned out, being dominated by search and social media the way that it has. And so a lot of people blame newspapers for not seeing the future or creating the future. But newspapers had been in the electronic retrieval of information business since the early 1980s. There had been several services offered, test marketed, where people could rent home terminals and subscribe to the basically just text. And some of these had varying levels of success in the 1980s, although the data transmission speeds were really too slow to make it viable. With the 90s, of course, the World Wide Web exploded in mid-decade, so that's where most newspapers have gone, wisely, away from the walled gardens of the Yahoo or AOL, some of these other services, and so they've gone to the open web, but now, like I say, they've been going behind the paywall in many instances, so they knew things were going to change, but I don't think anybody knew how exactly they were going to change. They had experimented enough to come to the conclusion that this wasn't a threat to them, and who knows, they may yet be right.
Now, back to the point of the kind of newspaper we'll see, and I'm speaking as a consumer, of course. We've noticed from journalists of your vintage, you're slightly older than I am, that newsrooms in the city across the continent are hiring younger journalists, people who say my age, who are probably working for a lot cheaper than people of your age. Does that have an effect on the kind of journalism we have? And I'm not just talking about the lack of institutional memory or history, say, but just in terms of the kind of skills that a good journalist would need.
Yes, I believe it has, because in downsizing, most newspapers have offered buyouts to senior staff, who, like you say, tend to be more expensive, and the more junior staff have been retained because they're more tech-savvy. And I think this has resulted in a tremendous loss of institutional memory. When I was growing up, I remember we had great writers and columnists, like Denny Boyd and Alan Fotheringham and Jim Taylor. I don't think that, the writers at the Sun and Province today can really match up with them. And perhaps that has also something to do with the loss of readership.
And so how do you correct that? I mean, do we just have to wait for these guys to get older?
I don't know if you can correct it. perhaps they might be wise to hire back some of the, older and wiser journalists. But ironically enough, some of them have been going online and writing for publications such as the Taiyi that we have here in Vancouver. There are a lot of former Pacific Press journalists writing for them, and so as a result, this institutional memory has instead gone online.
Yeah. What sort of proprietors do newspapers need to have?
I think they need to have reasonable proprietors. The problem with the newspaper business, as I point out in the book, is that it was so financially lucrative, its business success really may have been the worst thing that ever happened to it, because they were so profitable, they became bought up by large corporations and squeezed for every nickel. Now, large corporations seem to be divesting themselves, not always voluntarily, and so they're having to make do with lower profit levels and lower expectations. So I think if newspaper proprietors got smart, they would invest in the product, and I think that you'd see a lot more people reading them.
The free newspapers, the commuter papers, I mean, that's something that started, I guess, in 2008?
It started in Sweden, really, with the Metro International chain, of which there is also one in Vancouver. They have editions all around the world. The problem is that with the recent financial crisis, they've been hit hardest of all, because as advertising has gone down, they don't have the reader revenue to fall back on. They can't hike their cover price because they don't have a cover price. And so in many places around the world, these have been folding. There are still two in Vancouver, the Metro and the 24 Hours, which you mentioned. But for how much longer, I'm not sure.
But they have added something, haven't they, to the newspaper culture?
Yes, a little bit, but when you read them, you'll find that there's not much in them. It's basically designed, you know, to be read in 20 minutes on your commute, mm-hmm. your bus ride or your SkyTrain ride. And it's really McNews, McNuggets, and I don't really know if it's competition for news so much. It's a little bit of competition for advertising, but I don't really think that, you know, they are consequential in the way that the dailies are the Southern Province, the National Post, and the Globe and Mail. You just don't find much in the Metro or 24 Hours.
What do you make of the newspapers that we have in this town? I mean, the Globe and Mail has a BC section, which is rather good. The Sun seems to be a shadow of what it once was. I mean, it's a very thin paper physically now.
Yes, readers in Vancouver have been underserved for years because of the Pacific Press monopoly. I made this point in my first book. They have... you know, the lack of competition has deprived readers of both quantity and quality, I believe, of news. And most importantly, it's robbed them of diversity of perspectives, because it used to be that the province was a conservative paper and the Sun was a liberal paper, and now it seems that they're both conservative papers, and so you don't actually see that diversity of perspective anymore. So, yeah, readers have been shortchanged in Vancouver for many years, going back to at least 1980 when Southam bought the Sun in addition to owning the province, so it had both newspapers. But particularly since Conrad Black took over and started with the cost cutting in the mid-1990s and the sale to Canwest Global in 2000, of course, and it's been a steady downhill ride.
What do you make of there are rumors that he may, Conrad Black, buy a newspaper in this country shortly.
Well, you know, there are rules against non-citizens buying newspapers in this country. Conrad Black renounced his Canadian citizenship, you may recall, a number of years ago when he wanted to take a seat in the House of Lords in the UK. He had to, I believe, petition to even get back into the country as a resident. But under Canadian tax regulations, publications that are not majority owned by Canadian citizens, advertising in those publications is not tax deductible, which discourages advertising. So I think Conrad Black might be thwarted on that point. But you never know. He might try and get around it.
The last book that I talked to you about was Aspernation. And... you talked a great deal in that book about convergence and this idea that was not only happening in this country with the Asper properties, but other media outlets throughout the continent. In reading this new book, Greatly Exaggerated, convergence didn't work.
No.
And you were proved right.
As we discussed actually in our last interview 7 years ago, it had proved a bit of a disaster shortly after the year 2000 when what I call the convergence tsunami washed over Canada and reshaped our news media. It had a lesser effect in the U.S. because there is a prohibition. The Federal Communications Commission has a long-standing prohibition on newspaper publishers holding television licenses. There's no such prohibition in Canada, which allowed for the reshaping of our country's media. Like I say, in the year 2000, the CTV network was bought up by Bell Canada, which then partnered it with the Globe and Mail. Canwest bought the Southam newspapers from Conrad Black, and of course they already own the Global Television Network. And in the province of Quebec, Quebecor, one of the largest newspaper publishers there, bought the TVA network. Ironically, Quebec is the only place where the convergence model still exists. Canwest went bankrupt, of course, and was forcibly deconverged about the same time CTV Globe Media voluntarily deconverged. The Thompson family, which owns the Globe and Mail, found that the two media were just fundamentally incompatible, and they had some irreconcilable differences with CTV, so they decided to go their own way. So in Canada is probably where the convergence model hit hardest and crashed hardest. There is probably some limited application for the convergence model, but newspapers and televisions are, it's been found, just two fundamentally different media. There's now a worldwide phenomenon of deconvergence that is being seen. Most big media companies are splitting off their television and newspaper divisions. News Corp did it recently. The Tribune Company, which recently came out of bankruptcy, I believe, will be the next. So instead of convergence, what we're seeing now is called webvergence. All media are going online. You know, all newspapers, all television stations, all radio stations have a website, but they do it separately, and they do it quite differently. Mm-hmm. Broadcasters tend to do more podcasting, uploading their audio and video files. Yes, the convergence model was a bit of a disaster, and it resulted in, like I say, the bankruptcy of Canwest Global Communications, which bet heavily on convergence. So, like I say, it's rather ironic that convergence proved to be their undoing.
So this is a hopeful book, isn't it?
It is, because I see newspapers enduring. In what form, it's hard to tell. I believe, you know, that they may become smaller yet. They may become smaller in size. More of them may go tabloid. A lot of them may become a more of an upscale product. Like you see the Globe and Mail now, it has the high-quality glossy paper, heat press, I believe it's called, the coated paper. In San Francisco, they have the same. So I think newspapers may become more like a daily magazine, less content, but more colorful and higher quality paper. But I believe they'll be with us for some good long time to come.
The beginning of the book has your introduction, which talks about how this book came about. It's something that you've been working on for a very long time. But it's also, in terms of the book itself, it's something that got published very quickly. I guess 6 months ago, did you think this book would be out now?
No, I like you say, I'd been working on it for a long time. My publisher first proposed it about 5 years ago, and, well, I study newspapers, so little bits of research that I have done along the way have contributed to this book, and I worked on it for most of 2013, I had promised it to my publisher by the end of this past summer mm-hmm. of 2013, and I didn't quite make it. I believe I submitted my draft manuscript on October the 1st, and he kind of hummed and hawed and said, well, you know, it's too late for the spring catalog. It was supposed to come out in the spring of 2015. He said, we're going to have to put it over till next fall. Then he started reading it, and he quickly realized that this couldn't wait till next fall. It couldn't wait till next spring. It had to come out right now, he said, and so I'd been looking forward to taking a bit of time off and unwinding, and instead I found I had to redouble my efforts to... I hadn't even written the introduction or the preface, and then there was the whole proofreading process. I had to write the index, which was something new for me. So, yes, it's been a bit of a helter-skelter experience to get it into print, but we have. And so I'm hoping that it will make a difference, and it will change some people's minds about the future of newspapers, because, like I say, I believe they have a future.
So wait a minute. October 1st of 2014, you submitted the manuscript. We're talking the morning of December 19th. I've had the book for, I think, a week and a half, 2 weeks now.
Yes. We went to press at the end of October, or the beginning of November, I think. The publication date, I think, is November 27th.
Yes.
So this all came together fairly rapidly. My publisher, Rolf Maurer, is also an old newspaper person like myself, and he likens it more to a process of journalism than publishing. We have citations in the book from October of 2014. And like I say, the book was published in November of 2014. So the only other book that I'm aware of that's come to press so quickly was a book on the New Orleans Times Picayune, which I reviewed, called Hell or High Water. And it was similarly published by a small house, which is, I guess, more nimble, can act more quickly than the large publishers. And it similarly came to press in a matter of weeks, not months, or even, as at most publishers, years.
And so this is a book that people can get as an e-book as well. And I've got a copy of the trade paperback on the desk here. This is what I was reading. This is a sign, I guess, of how the publishing business has changed and developed itself.
Yes, because everything's done electronically now, you can move a lot faster. The problem is, of course, you might miss a few errors and things, which we've been catching. And I actually just submitted corrections for the ebook, which should be coming out any time now. There were quite a few things that we missed in the book, a long list of corrections. So we're hoping that this one will go into a second printing. We only printed 1,600 compared to 2,000 for all of my previous books, but one of the reasons for that was because Rolf said that going to press as quickly as we did, he was sure that there were some errors that would need to be corrected, and well, there certainly are.
So what did you make of the reception to the Pacific Press book? Because I remember that's the first time I ever came across you was I heard you on the Rafe Mayer program promoting that book. And I remember you telling him at the time that this was a book that, as you say, the subtitle said, it was unauthorized, and I'm sure you didn't get very much help from whatever institution owned the Vancouver Sun at the time, or the province.
Yes, they weren't very happy, I think, that I'd written the book, and they weren't very cooperative. We wanted to use some photographs from their archives, which they refused to allow, so that's why the subtitle became The Unauthorized Story of Vancouver's Newspaper Monopoly. The book did get fairly good reviews in academic journals and literary magazines, but it wasn't reviewed in many newspapers. The Vancouver Sun at that time, 2001, 2002, they did review it. I think they felt an obligation to review it, and I understand there was a considerable discussion as to exactly who would review it, and they decided on Peter Deberet, the former dean of journalism at the University of Western Ontario, and he gave it kind of a mixed review. It was actually fairly balanced, but it wasn't reviewed in any other newspapers, and certainly Asper Nation was not reviewed in even the Vancouver Sun or any of the CanWest newspapers. It was reviewed in the Globe and Mail, which gave it a very nice review. I'm hoping that this book, being hopeful about the future of newspapers, will get more newspaper reviews, but as my publisher points out, it does go into some detail on some of the things that newspapers have done that might be considered a little bit deceptive or deceitful as far as their own business goes. So I don't know if newspapers will be eager to play up that angle.
But it is a great read, and congratulations on it, and the quick turnaround from writing it to getting it in our hands here. It's nice to meet you, and we're taping this, as I said, on December 19th, which is your birthday. So happy birthday, and thanks for coming in to do this.
Thanks very much for both.
MarkEdge.com is the website. The book is called Greatly Exaggerated, The Myth of the Death of Newspapers. It's from New Star Books. Do get it. It's a really fascinating read. Mark's done a tremendous job in terms of the research here, and it'll be a great view onto what's happened with newspapers, not only in this town, in this part of the world, this country, but also across North America, where we're seeing a lot of things happen, stuff happen very quickly, and it looks to the future, which I think we're all interested in, if we aren't already. Mark Edge joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.